Creative. This is episode 15. I'm going to keep the intros very short this week. I have been able to speak to a guy called Jules Earhart. He is a previous co-owner of Us Two and ran the studio over in New York, and recently wrote two fantastic pieces in the last few years, one in 2016 and one in 2018. If you have a look on Medium and search for The State of the Digital Nation, you'll find those pieces. Once I'd read those, I was kind of blown away by how Jules is thinking about the industry. I found a lot of things that sort of complemented my own thoughts, although Jules had put them 10 times better. And I thought, okay, well, let's reach out to Jules. Let's see whether he would perhaps share some time and come onto the podcast. And luckily, he said yes. So this first part, Jules talks a lot about his obsession with changing the terms of business for what he calls the creative class. And he's very kind of concerned with, how do we stop creativity being seen as a commodity? Can we look at new models? Can we make equity for expertise a reality? And just overall, like, what does a new creative economy look like? So I'm going to leave it there. We're going to get straight into the chat. And this is going to be a great episode, and there's more to come as well.
Jules, welcome to the Never Not Creative podcast.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Thank you for thank you for coming on. I've been a massive fan now for a few years since you wrote The State of the Digital Nation. Obviously, you've been a kind of co-owner of Us Two in New York, and so speaking from and writing from quite a lot of experience. And now you're off kind of doing your own thing, I understand.
Indeed, yeah. I left Us Two around the early 2017, so it's been a really interesting year and a bit since, kind of cooking up a new future.
Yeah, it's very exciting. So I think we'll definitely get into some of that during the chat. And I'm keen to kind of just go back to what it was. Like, I'm sure with all the views that you have in terms of where the industry is going and what needs to change, and in some cases, like, quite transformative change. Was there like a tipping point for, like, was there anything that you experienced in your career which was sort of, I don't ever want to see this happen again? And also, you know, was it that, or was it something else that led to writing The State of the Digital Nation piece?
Right, it's a bit of a mix. So let's see. So, like, State of the Digital Nation were two pieces I wrote for kind of for myself to organize my thoughts. But one was in 2016, which was basically reflecting on Us Two's journey, which was a digital product studio, and we saw the industry evolving. Basically, the agencies were getting brought up by consultant ad holding groups at the time, and a lot of design was getting consolidated, and basically seeing what kind of path could be plotted through that. And Us Two, of course, was a digital product studio, and I think I might have coined that phrase in the piece. And the focus is doing client service work. It's doing your launching your own products, one of which ended up being Monument Valley. And it's also working a bit in venture, kind of in the risk-based space. So that's why I was writing that. And it definitely helped me organize my thoughts. And in 2018, when I wrote the new one, that was very much a reflection of, rather than the studio perspective, it was more about the individual's perspective. Because I'd left Us Two, and I'd been at the heart of that, kind of our growth for a good 8-9 years. And it was really reflecting on, you know, having stepped out the industry properly, out of the kind of letting the opiate wear off and getting out the hamster wheel, what choices we as individuals in the kind of creative class would need to take to kind of shape a new future. So I think, though, for me, both pieces are a reflection of where I was at in my kind of career and life. The things that I think were pivotal for me, I've got this real obsession with how we change the terms of business for the creative class. Because I kind of, one thing we did at us too is get, you know, offer a premium product at a premium price. And I think we pushed the model as far as it could go. That's always been my obsession. How do we change the terms of business? And I think I do remember us too, we built H&M's global mobile commerce back in the day when a lot of big brands still weren't mobile. And we delivered this global mobile commerce solution to them and we got paid very well. But I remember it must have been a year or two later, their annual report popped up and it just casually mentioned that the mobile channel was now worth like €1 billion a year. And it was really pivotal for me because I was like, shit, fuck man. Like we know how to make people a lot of fucking money and I don't want to be sitting on my porch in my 80s rocking back and forth just reflecting how much money, how much value we created for other people. So I think that was really an example of like really driving new thinking about how we could change in terms of business. So
yeah, that's and I think one of the things that I sort of liked in the most recent piece as well, I think, was when you started talking about getting paid for mind, not getting paid for time.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, there's quite a few discussions that happen around value-based pricing, for example.
Yep.
But then they become incredibly hard to execute. And to even get, you know, because there's a lot of risk involved and actually you need to pay people next week. You know, and so how long is it going to take for that stuff to come off? How have you kind of been thinking about making that work?
I think that was one of my three vows to myself. A, that I'd never be involved in the agency. I'd run another agency. And one of them was I'd be paid for time and not for mind, were kind of one of my three frameworks for whatever I was going to do next. I think for me, the diagnosis I'd made of the core problem with the industry was that we're basically selling time and not expertise. And because of that, and what I call the island prison that we kind of washed up on decades ago, it's really allowed everything we do, like the rich variety of creativity, which can be across any kind of any part of the discipline, to be homogenized and commoditized and like ground up like into a sausage meat and sold at market. And I think as soon as we agreed to sell what we do on an hourly basis, it was the beginning of trapping us on this island. So value-based pricing is one alternative way of, you know, getting paid. You know, I think it's very hard to do with big companies. Often, you know, if you try and come up with alternative revenue agreements, which is another way of phrasing it, and you might have a stakeholder at a big client or brand who's really excited about it. As soon as that proposal goes to the five floors of lawyers, it's game over, or procurement. They're like, well, we don't have a box for this, so you just pay them for their time. Yeah. So I think it's always going to be a challenge if we're going to try and drive this new model with big brands and big enterprise, because they're just not set up for it. So part of my focus with Factory, my new studio, is seeing if we can normalize and build in these models within the startup space. And once we do that, then I do believe the enterprise will pick up on it in whatever 4 to 8 years, that we'll begin to have a new, a kind of wider set of options for how we engage people. But I think that time-based selling of our expertise is really killing us. And it's been a core component in kind of the breakdown of trust, because I just think the incentives are misaligned. So if anything, if I can distill my thinking down over the last year, it's been about how do we build models that A, align incentives between all parties, you know, agency and brand or individual and agency. And B, if creativity, as we know, can generate business growth, then how can we capture some of the upside of potential upside of the work we can do? And those are kind of drivers I like to think about, whether it be value-based or not, is how do we get off the island prison?
The just thinking about this, do we also, and actually I'm definitely all for it. I can think, having been both sides, does it also then, so let's say, okay, now, you know, the agencies and the people doing the work are kind of incentivized better because the reward is potentially much higher because of, you know, the work that they create. Is there then a kind of disincentive the other way on the clients, which is like, well, if we're really successful, then I end up having to pay a lot more for the work that I used to be getting by the hour. Have you had this kind of discussion with anyone around that, like that side of things?
I can probably, the discussions I've been having with startups are kind of probably a little bit similar. It's just, there's a Mexican standoff of sorts of like, well, hang on, you're demanding equity in return for your expertise, but you know, how do I know that's going to be worth something? And at the other side, you can say, well, look, your startup's worth absolutely nothing at all at this point. And together, we're going to make it worth something that's going to... So therefore, our incentives are fully aligned. Again, I think it's going to be really hard for us to drive innovative thinking with big brands and big procurement departments. Mm-hmm. But I do believe we can crack that nut by working with smaller companies and working with startups. And as so often with enterprise, they do like to catch up. But yeah, it's not an easy conversation. I think, again, it's banks of lawyers and procurement departments that can really stifle a lot of that.
Yeah. I kind of saw some of the stuff you talked about around, you know, could we go to a, rather than all of this kind of by the hour or by the day, like actually, could we go to a by the week or by the month rate? Yeah. And even in my last company, we started to look at trying to just, say that, you know, a 2-week sprint was going to cost X. And actually all you do is just buy 2-week sprints. And, you know, we can do whatever you want in that sprint. We can tackle the next problem. We can tackle the next, you know, we can work on the last one that we did. But you've always got to buy in 2 weeks, which gives us a lot more flexibility around kind of how we manage the work. And also, if there is to be any upside, then we can take advantage of it. Have you seen that model work? Is anyone doing it?
Yeah, I mean, very much so. I mean, I think look, even if you go to weekly or monthly billing, you're still kind of selling time. What I do think pushing for weekly or, you know, daily, weekly or monthly does, and if you know, management consultants, they sell teams by the month, so it's not a new concept at all. They're very good at selling stuff. But what it does do, it gets us away from the mentality of us selling units of time, these hours, and it shifts it, I've always thought, into a team over time instead of units of time. And then if a client or partner is buying a team over time, then it's a focus about what we're getting done. Not, you know, here's 4 people for 8 hours a day equals blah, blah, blah. It also really requires a degree of trust, which is a theme we'll touch upon later again, and maturity that together we'll deliver a, you know, a meaningful amount of value within that time. It doesn't mean, you know, we're going to do, you know, exhaustive, you know, specification and, you know, and deliver some exactly that to you. It means that we're going to work together. You're going to pay us for, you know, weeks or months. And, you know, I like to talk about the Moscow framework, which is, you know, just creating a list with lines in it, which is must have, should have, could have, and won't have. And just making sure everyone's very comfortable that we can achieve that. But yeah, look, the weekly, monthly thing, definitely push into. I remember even the mere fact of charging daily at us too. When we moved to daily, which is basically anything over 4 hours in the day was charged in the full day, as a full day, then I think we had 18% higher revenue for the same projects. And the logic there is, I mean, let's be honest, like, you know, I went to a summit for Designers Fund in San Francisco, and I had the floor briefly, and I kind of asked everyone, and these are all the design leaders across like a lot of famous startups in the Valley. I said, how many hours of creativity do you think a human being has in them a day? And I kind of put my hand, you know, I left my head right. I said 9, 8, 7, 6. But basically 4 hours, nearly everyone put their hand up. I had 2/3 of the room put their hand up. And frankly, you are only going to get 4 hours of creativity out of a human being a day. The rest is everything around it. And if you pretend someone needs to be there for 12 or 16 hours, you're just getting the same 4 hours anyway, but you're just raking it over like a field like manure. By having them there. So for me, recognizing that creativity is a finite resource every day, charging by the day at the very least, gets us away from that a little bit.
Yeah, I think, I mean, obviously, so the company I'm at now, Streamtime, we, you know, one of our big things is obviously how you're able to kind of track time and understand the the amount of cost and kind of and money as well coming into the business. But I do worry about this. I feel like almost back to that island prison you talked about, we changed the value conversation because the conversation that I often see clients having is it's like it rather they forget all about the output because they haven't seen it. All they've seen is the you know, the proposal. And the more detail you put in the proposal, the more it's going to be questioned.
Yeah.
And they start looking at kind of line by line, and do we really need to do this, and do we really need to do that? And then the whole discussion before you even start the relationship is about how they can save money. Yet actually what you were both trying to come to the table with on this is, how can we make more money? How can we grow a company? How can we, you know, find success? And actually, you know, it seems that too often the conversation is about how can we reduce risk? And you know, if it doesn't work out, we'll end up spending less, versus how can we all do fantastically?
Well, I think it speaks again to like nearly every model that we're kind of trapped in, is the incentives are misaligned. You know, if you look at management consultants, and who are the worst at it, I mean, their job is to sell time. The partners are there to sell time, sell teams. The bigger and longer and higher headcount they have on a project with the client, the more money they make, you know? So there's no incentive to ultimately answer the question, and management consultants are fantastic at not actually specifically answering questions, just kind of throwing up 100 more. That's, for me, comes down to, it's a big problem. Like, you touched a bit on data internally. I think it's super valuable for a studio to be cognizant of the cost of its hour, because tracking, I mean, at us too, we had, like, you know, I could tell you every individual on every project down to the cent or pound, how much money they'd made, how much profit each project had made. And that's kind of that's your headlights, you know, it's your dashboard while you're driving. It's really handy to know at the end of every day, if you've got the right systems, how you're doing. And now, if at the other end of the spectrum, you kind of completely refuse to do hours like that and process them, you're not going to get the data you need to respond. And it might take 8 weeks or longer to realize you're making a giant fucking loss on something. Mm. So I think it's really valuable that we track time to work out, to get our data. Secondly, I think that data should be something shared with absolutely everyone, because I think one of my kind of call to arms is that we in the creative class kind of just clue up, you know, just wise up. I think we've been really naive about commercials and money and the way capital works. And I remember, you know, not that long ago, you know, when I was at us2, I just kind of started, and I mentioned like having secured a certain rate in the Monday morning meeting, and I was like, immediately jumped on by the founders, Mr. Six, saying, we're never talking about money here. And then years later, you know, every single person gets every bit of data about how every project's doing. I think it's our responsibility as creators to understand how money works, how stuff's profitable or not. It's okay to say we can do stuff within a certain time frame. Yeah. This notion that creativity should be it should be unbound, shouldn't be sullied by commercial intent, has really held us all back. And I think that's it's a tiny like shift, well, a huge shift we've got to make as creators if we're going to create if we're going to develop a new creative economy, which is my obsession. And so for me, the bridge to cross into is like, we're not selling time, we're selling expertise. You know, I've been meeting more and more with startups and putting teams together for startups. And like, you know, and they always go, oh, look, how much, that's a lot of, you know, you're asking for 5% of equity for this amount of time. And I said, well, no, I'm not. I'm delivering you expertise of a very high grade from industry leading experts. That's what you're getting in return for. You're not getting their time, you're getting their expertise.
Yeah. I was going to ask something else, and then that made me think of, have you heard of the slicing the pie model?
No. So
there's a guy, I forget what his name is, Mike something, I think, who wrote a book called Slicing the Pie. And it's actually the opposite of what you just said, which is the idea being that you track the amount of effort that each kind of party puts into the business. But that is a sliding scale over time. So if your effort drops, your equity drops.
Yep.
And so it does become about kind of effort, and you could probably build expertise into it by just kind of weighting the time spent or something like that. But it's meant to be quite easy to use, but I remember trying to do it with a startup, and we just went, phew. And then it was like, you felt like you had to put the time in because it was you became hostage to it. It's like, if I don't keep the time up, then my equity is going to drop.
But if effort means time, then it's completely the wrong
metric. Then it's the wrong way around. Exactly. You
know? I think, you know, I always say, you know, I've had the privilege in my journey in the States to meet a lot of like founders and very super talented people. Like, you know, let's say Alex Turing, founder of Giphy, which is like an $80 billion media company. An afternoon with him for the right company would be worth 3 months with a team at McKinsey. Yeah. So what are you going to say? That's 4 hours versus, you know, whatever, three months of consultant hours. It's completely incomparable. And I think we just got to shift that mindset, which means, you know, we've got to have a bit more self-respect about what we offer to the world. And, you know, if people don't get that, yes, it's our problem because they're buying our product, but we got to help them understand that they're buying expertise, not, you know, not time.
We're never really taught the commercial side of things, I don't think, in the creative industry. Like, you know, if just as you get into the industry or anything like that, then it's kind of also why the management consultants is, that's where they start, right? It's like, how do you, you know, they're all kind of complete capitalism machines and monsters, which is like you're taught that from day one. And then when you get into the business, you are, that's exactly what, you know, you start doing, and it's just second nature. But in the creative industry, I don't know of anyone that teaches it. You'd have to do it as some sort of add-on. And the worst conversation, like someone could tell you that they hate your work and you would take that over having to have a conversation around money.
Yeah.
It's kind of, you know, and I think people take advantage of that, but also it's ourselves to blame, really.
Yeah, I thought a lot about that, and I kind of had an epiphany of sorts recently. Me, like, I used to be very low level, as in, you know, shit engineer and an okay designer. So my background, I've always had a commercial lens on the industry and new models and kind of trying to represent what creativity or product can do for different companies. But my lens has always been a commercial. So I've never had that issue. Mm. My job has always been actually to represent the needs of the studio and the team and to create the right environment for the right work to be done. So I've never had an issue with that commercial side of it. And what I realized recently was, you know, Frank, and again, I learned that ad hoc. Like I was reflecting recently, there is not a course to go to study how to run a studio or an agency.
No.
Just kind of do it, and then you fuck it up one or two times and you get less worse in it, and then you speak to people and you know, you get better with each studio. It doesn't make any sense given it's such a multi-billion-dollar industry that there isn't more of a formal education. But which is why I've also focused, like, especially in the last couple of years, of sharing as much of my experience and time with people as possible to you know, help pay it forward, because I and us two had loads of help and support with people willing to point out turds, not to step in. But my reflection recently is around empathy. And, like, yeah, look, management consultants get paid shitloads more than us, and they also operate with less empathy, I'd say. Mm. And, you know, bankers operate with zero empathy. They're very comfortable with externalities, you know. And I think what I realized recently was that as creatives, empathy is our greatest asset, it's our greatest resource, but it's also our greatest weakness, because we consider other people, too much. And you need to consider other people when you create experiences or music or any kind of experiences for someone or for someone else. But when it comes to commercials and negotiating, I think we're really going to dial the empathy down and go a bit more Kanye, which is just fuck you, pay me. Like, I have self-respect, I have worth. And I think our empathy is holding us back. And I'm asking us to kind of, when it comes to the commercial side, put that down, you know, stop kind of shirking when you're pushing an invoice across the table or demanding your worth. Because the more all of us concede that ground, in fact, the fact all of us have conceded that ground has led us down this kind of dead end and systemic collapse in the creative industry we're headed towards. Because we've been just as responsible as asshole procurement departments have in squeezing us as to agreeing to it.
I feel like we just stumbled upon a conspiracy, which is the procurement departments and the accountants actually were the ones that came up with human-centered design. That we are all much more empathetic, and then we don't want to ask as much money, and we're less commercially savvy for our services.
Honestly, I've worked with a bunch of teams in my time, and we'd put together multi-million pound or dollar proposals, and I have so often teams looking, we always made the proposals together. I think that was a good thing about us too. And BD at least was that the teams formulated the response and we'll present the response. So it was kind of very joined up. But you know, when it had like whatever, seven figures in it, even less experienced BDs would be like, oh shit, should we put a discount on this? You're like, let's put 10% discount on it, so it goes under a million or whatever. And I'm like, hang on. Like, go to fucking Google right now and type in the company name and ask what its market cap is. If it's got a fucking B in it, yeah, has it got a B? Yeah, okay. Now, how do you feel about pushing this like £2 million job? Oh, I think I'm okay. And lo and behold, you go in with the confidence and the self-respect, and you usually end up getting paid. And you've got to be willing to not work with people who want nickel and dime you, and that's fine. But you know, there's a mindset that we're just shirking our value, and we sure as fuck know that we're going to create like at least tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars of value, you know?
Yeah. That is a word. That's a dirty word that comes up a lot. Discount. I think there is this, you know, we can do this one for a discount because it's our first job, or, you know, we can do this one for a discount because we really want to do the work, or it's going to be a great piece for the reputation of our studio. And it's like, you're already saying this work isn't worth as much. And it's very dangerous to kind of give anything away for free.
Yeah, I mean, it must be tough being a photographer right now because everyone's got cameras and everyone's willing to do stuff for free. But it's the same, you know, if you're David LaChapelle, you know, and you can just tell them to fuck off. So the quest is to become very, very fucking good at what you do, and then you can command the terms. And if you're designing fucking web banners for your local auto shop, then yeah, maybe you can't play that tune. But frankly, you know, all these conversations about charging for value or commanding equity or whatever have to be on the basis of truly excelling at your art. You know, it's only at that point can you kind of define the terms.
So we have to get better at understanding our own businesses and how to make money. There's another part there, which is to be able to truly have that conversation with a client, we've got to understand their business and what makes money.
Yeah.
Is that quite a big leap or a big step for some of the creative industry, if not a lot of it?
I kind of think it is. I mean, it's wrapped up a bit in the fact that everyone's now talking about doing digital transformation, which for me is just kind of fucking madness because, you know, if you're really talking about business impact of your work, and you're wrapping it up in kind of digital transformation, I don't really believe many agencies at all have the capabilities to, you know, to pull that off. Yes, we can design something, create something, and do service design, product experience design, and brand. But having that translate through to hard numbers is slightly bigger reach. I certainly don't think most studios, you know, including us too, maybe are capable of doing digital transformation. Because if I said, can you send me, like, give me some data or on the dog walking market in South America, a management consultant and an MBA would probably be able to pull up some data and, you know, build a business case for it. Your average studio couldn't. Your RGAs, your AKQAs, there's no way they could. So I think that's harder. So I think it's easier in the world of startup because you're starting from an earlier point, and you can literally measure the impact you're making more directly. But yeah, I think it's still on us to have a better understanding of how our clients, of businesses work. Whether the digital transformation bandwagon is the right way, I don't know.
Yeah. So if you're an established agency,
yeah,
how easily could you move to a new model, do you think? Or is this a case of it's going to spawn out of agencies and people kind of starting again and new businesses or agencies within agencies, which I don't think have ever worked that well?
Yeah, I kind of think, like, given there aren't that many independent agencies left, that everyone's been sucked up by the Borg or assimilated by the Borg, Accenture, and I know that's happened down in Australia a lot as well.
Yeah, quite a bit, yeah.
The Monkeys and a few others got kind of swallowed up. I think it's a big issue that you're kind of witnessing the homogenization of design. If everything's an IBM system or an Accenture design system, then what does that mean for creativity? I don't think you're going to have such a differentiated kind of rich landscape to tap into. I always get political, don't I? What I see is you're going to get people who've sold their companies who are going to leave that system and they're going to build out new models. And I think I've spoken to a lot of agency owners, like, and I always ask them, because it was what I was asking myself, like, if you could start again completely fresh knowing everything, you know, with all the context, would you do the same thing again? And absolutely every single fucking person, there must be 100 plus, said no fucking way would they do it. Now, I think the agency journey is an amazing kind of privilege. You get to see the world, you get to work with lots of different companies and see how things work. But for me, I believe now we have to treat that as boot camp. And that knowledge and experience is simply like a tux that we're putting on, or a cocktail dress that lets us go past the cheap slot machines or the pokies at the RSL and go to the high stakes table at the back of the casino where people are wearing suits and the stakes are different. I think we've got to treat that experience as boot camp. And I think if we can realize, you know, that if we realize that we can create value and business growth, then we should become, that makes our expertise an asset that someone can invest in. So I believe there's no way it's going to happen with companies innovating within a WPP or they're owned by Accenture, because it's just not simply isn't part of the remit. But I do believe we're just going to get simply have new models. And that's been my mission, is like, how can we demonstrate that there are new models? And I completely believe there are, but it's got to come on the premise that we believe in ourselves and we believe we can create value. And what that does is create a new category of asset, which I call creative capital.
So before we get into creative capital, this, because I know you set me up there for a segue, which I'm almost there on that.
Nearly,
I just
wanted
to quickly ask on part of that model is this kind of equity stake.
Yep.
And I think in the past, it's often been talked about services for equity, whereas actually even that isn't far enough really in terms of what you're talking about, which is this expertise for equity.
Yeah.
So how is that conversation different when you're having it with a startup?
Well, I would say the concept of services for equity isn't new. It's not new in the creative profession. It's not new in the legal profession. But what it has been, the instances we've seen so far, I mean, us too, we helped a couple of startups launch by building the whole product and taking an equity stake in it. Red Antler, Dice, which is a great mobile ticketing app, was one of those. Red Antler did Casper's branding and took equity. You've also got, there's a bunch of different companies who've done work in return for equity, but it's always been like a side project. They've always been within the larger construct of a paid for time client service consultancy. Yeah. And, you know, certainly once those companies get acquired, that's out the window. Like Fuse Project is another really interesting example of a creative studio with Yves Bahar, a kind of superstar designer, who did a lot of, you know, co-ownership of and equity positions in Jawbone and a bunch of other companies.
Yeah.
But once they got purchased outright, that all stopped and they're just a regular client service consultant, because their owner's like, well, what the fuck's this risk-based work? If I can have money in the bank and sell heads, then stick to that. So it's not new. What I think we should shoot for is taking what we've learned from that, sharing it and building like the purest expression of that model, which is not restricted by, you know, having to basically pay rent next month, just as you said, or next week. And so you come back to the point you made, which is basically any kind of risk-based work can only within the existing model come off the back of like a lot of success and good luck. Like us two's journey, you know, was a huge amount of luck, the way the industry shifted around us, the way, you know, the chances we took. Monument Valley was a beautiful product, but also just the universe kind of resonated with it at the right time.
And a load of failures, right? There was, you know, five or six other things before Monument Valley.
Yeah, there were. Yeah, it's a good point. I was catching up with Daniel Berker, who's used to be Google Ventures, and he was saying that he highlighted that to me when I was talking about Monument Valley. So, well, how many, you did lots of things before. So if the games division at us two, or the games effort at us two was a startup, you pivoted about, you know, six times.
And 8 years in. Eight years in, you're successful. Yeah.
So the kind of, exactly. Like, you know, even if it brought in whatever 15 and 20 million for one and two, a lot of money was spent before that till it kind of got above. So, it's not as the narratives are always a bit more gritty than they're portrayed.
But the on that point, like the narrative, so I also used to work at RGA, and the one thing that RGA was so good at was telling the same story again and again and again, or the same three stories again and again and again. And it was just literally all the work that was being done was to was to just go, okay, what is the next story that we can tell? So, you know, so it went from Nike Fuel Band and Nike Plus to then Beats and the Beats music service, and then Beats being bought by Apple and creating a $3.2 billion brand. And it was excellent storytelling, like incredible in terms of the way, like, you could go out and sell RGA and everyone's like, yeah, we'll have one of those, please. And it was so good. And I think it's like, I think sometimes as creators, you can kind of get bored of selling the same thing. Like, you go, oh, but we've been talking about that for a while now. I think we kind of need something else. And it's like if it works, you should use it. And also it's that stuff that gives you your confidence. Like, if you won a whole heap of awards 3 years ago for a project or a product or something, keep getting as much value out of it as possible. Don't feel like it's getting, you know, boring, because it might be boring to you because you say it every day, but actually most people are hearing it for the first time.
Well, I agree. I think a lot of narratives are kind of rose-tinted bullshit, and as humans, we tend to weave whatever narrative we want after the fact. I think what I wrote about in 2016, one of the reasons the ad industry is now completely fucked is that they didn't really do the work when it came to getting into the product side. So, you know, RGAs and AKQAs, they basically largely redid their case studies and said the dancing elf on the back of the cereal packet was now a product project rather than a marketing or advertising project. And they didn't really do the hard work to kind of change the way they delivered, you know, rather than a very creative director down-led process. You know, good product design comes from kind of flatter teams, insights-led, bottom-up approach. And they didn't do the work on the technical side to really be able to deliver product meaningfully. And I think them pretending they could, as you said, that offering that narrative, but ultimately failing to deliver on it, has led to this, like, ultimately a lot of brands going, well, this is bullshit. Like, you know, we're not getting what we were promised. And so many bridges have been burnt that the trust breakdown has spread from not just advertising and marketing agencies to their clients, where the value they're getting is now being questioned, but the contagion of trust has spread everywhere. So, like, us twos and IDOs, the kind of revered side of design, you know, which is, you know, you like to laugh at advertising and marketing because we're not them. actually, and I say in the piece, it's like we've been watching this multi-car pile-up and then suddenly realize we're in the fucking same crash, you know, and that trust, all the projects begin to go in-house, less work being out there, the commoditization is happening absolutely fucking everywhere. Narratives are important, but you've got to be able to follow through on what you're promising.
Yes.
Because once it's a lie and that shit gets found out, that's literally where we're at.
Thanks for listening this week. As always, please follow us on @NVRNotCreative on the socials. Go visit nevernotcreative.org. Remember, there's some great events coming up, 2 in Sydney, 1 in Melbourne, and the launch of Mentally Healthy 2018 results coming soon. Been working on those today, in fact. Again, some really interesting findings. Thanks to Streamtime. Check out streamtime.net if you run a creative business and you want to take a look at how to run your studio better and to use software that kind of improves the time and data that you record in your business. Go check it out at streamtime.net, and we'll see you for part 2 of my chat with Jules next week. Have a great week.